I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, the political scientist Tom Ferguson, has defined the golden rule of politics this way: he who has the gold rules. But then it's important also whose gold a politician has. In the Bush-Gore race for president this year, the running tabulation of campaign contributions, hard money and soft, gives you the general picture that the Republican from Texas, Governor George W. Bush, is the candidate of big oil, agribusiness, banking, the healthcare industry, and money in general. The Democrat from Tennessee, Vice President Al Gore, is the candidate of Hollywood, the labor unions, a few good blocks of Wall Street, and lawyers in general. We're looking at the investment side of this presidential campaign this hour. Why might you want to buy your way into the leadership of the planet? And what do the why do the big interests spend in the aggregate hundreds of millions of dollars to do it? Connection listeners, just what are they buying? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Nobody follows the money more carefully than our guest Tom Ferguson at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His teacher, Walter Dean Burnham, joins us from the University of Texas in Austin. Professor Burnham is famous for mapping the changing shape of American politics, the alignment of regions, classes, states, generations, as well as interests. We're starting with the money trail, Connection listeners. If there is a dime's worth of difference between the two major contenders, whose dime is it? 1-800-423-TALK joins the conversation. Whose dime is it? Tom Ferguson.
Well, it's a lot of people's. I mean, look, let's begin, though, by straightening one thing out. This is an equal opportunity world. She who has the money can rule, too. I mean, everybody can sell out now and does. I mean, look, you could the best way to do this, I think, is review the bidding. I mean, basically, if you like Bush, you're in favor of, you know, unrestrained globalization and what you might call wide open casino style capitalism, global 911 service provided by a military that's enlarged even more, even though it's already bigger than the next 10. You'd like to do an immediate deployment of an ABM missile that probably won't work, can be decoyed probably by high school kids working in their own home labs, and would probably bust up all the alliances that the U.S. has spent a huge amount of money building in the last 40 years. You're in favor of a drug war in Colombia, huge tax cuts to be paid for out of a surplus that's probably never going to materialize to the size he says, privatization of Social Security. You're in favor of real casinos. I mean, there's a lot of those floating around, the Republicans, too. And you'd like China to be our trading partner, but not our friend. I believe they say a competitor. If you, on the other hand, you like Al Gore, you're in favor of wide-open casino-style capitalism and unrestrained globalization. You'd like a smaller increase in the military budget, since you're already bigger than the next 10. You're in favor of the war in Colombia. You'd like a smaller tax cuts. Partial privatization of Social Security, real casinos, they're also sitting around on the Democratic Party. And then you'd like to spend some of the surplus that probably won't materialize on education and a bit on medical care. And then you get to some real differences on the patient's Bill of Rights. And I think also on China policy, where the Democrats clearly don't talk the hostile line that the Republicans do, and talking a hostile line in a situation that is sort of explosive and in an area of the world where military spending's finally turned up after 10 years, that's really interesting. So you could say, yeah, there's a dime's worth of difference here. It's a lot of dimes and a lot of differences. It's a little hard to translate into big differences except in medical care and maybe very slightly on education for ordinary people. And that's sort of the problem we've got here, sort of taking this apart.
Well, all right. A lot of those differences, and they're interesting, you could dope out of just reading the papers and the, you know, the campaign speeches. I mean, it helps to be as sophisticated as you are. But what do the campaign disclosures of say, the trial lawyer money going into Gore, or the oil money that's just sort of written all over the Republican ticket, what does that tell you?
Well, you're right in both cases that both the trial lawyers and the large oil companies clearly have sort of, in some sense, bought a majority share of one party or another.
Kevin Phillips, an old-fashioned Nixon Republican, says it's the first big oil, all-oil ticket in American history.
That's unfair. I mean, we've had, 1936, 1948, an awful lot of American elections would probably qualify for that. It's also, you got it. Look, the The Bush folks are experienced investors. They're diversified. I mean, you hit it right the first time when you said this is a cross-section of money in general. And this is a if you count heads, I have no doubt that at least 65 or so percent of all, say, big businessmen or women in the United States probably support Bush. That still leaves a big chunk for Gore. And, of course, none of them are supporting Nader or Buchanan.
All right, but it doesn't come out that way when you read from the Center for Responsive Politics, the breakout of contributions by sector. Agribusiness, for example, is 4-1 Republican. Labor is, the labor unions
are
more than 4-1 Democrat.
No.
Hollywood, despite Joe Lieberman's strictures on, family standards and stuff, is Democratic.
Yep.
Big medicine is Republican. There are real contests here. It's not all one pool of shrewd, bet-hedging investors.
Don't look at me. I never bought the bet-hedging line. I actually think people who tell you everybody invests in everybody are clearly wrong. I mean, the way you get those kinds of claims is people look at the grossest possible evidence. I mean, there are big differences within political parties, so it makes sense if you're going to, for instance, when you look at congressional contributions, it's a fact that somebody like Joe Lieberman is much closer to the Republicans on a big block of issues than he is to the rest of his party. It makes perfect sense, therefore, for people to cross party lines and give to, say, Lieberman in Connecticut and two or three other insurance or pharmaceutical people in some other place, and they're Republicans. Republicans. You get that kind of, that's the kind of evidence that the papers banter around endlessly to make you think everybody buys everybody. They don't. You're right. I never thought that.
The other thing that, I want you to fill in a lot of things that the papers don't tell us. I mean, the papers and television tell us much more about Al Gore's kiss at the convention.
That's right.
Than about who is going to own his presidency.
Yeah.
They tell you much more about George Bush's misspent youth than about what big oil, what the Halliburton company really wants in the
That's
world.
Right.
What do they
yeah.
want?
See, well,
and what are they going to get?
In the case of the oil companies, I think it's pretty clear the China policy is a big driver. I mean, I was just in Beijing and had a bunch of quite illuminating talks with the Chinese. When you talk to them, they'll tell you all about how the Americans are everywhere trying to sort of keep them from getting oil. I mean, China now imports a lot of oil. They see that as a huge problem. This has yet to come up in anybody's discussion anywhere in the United States. I mean, you can't even find it in the scholarly discussions, but they're pretty bitter about it, particularly the way they claim the U.S. has tried to sort of keep them, for instance, from even getting oil storage stuff in the Straits of Malacca. This is the kind of stuff in Asia can lead eventually to a war. I mean, we've done this before. You may remember there were big troubles between the U.S. and Japan over oil before World War II. Indeed, it was the U.S. oil embargo that's often thought to have led to the Japanese decision to attack Pearl Harbor. Now, we're not anywhere like that, though some people on the Republican side talk as though they'd almost like to have a war with China.
Walter Dean Burnham, the money interest is only part of your portfolio, but what does it tell you about this campaign?
Well, it suggests that there's a fair amount of stability in these investment structures. They do flop around a little bit from time to time, but on the whole, the sources of revenues of the parties and the constituencies they appeal to at the macro business level haven't changed a whole lot in a long time. Clearly, for example, Republicans have been bashing away at trial lawyers for quite a while, not to mention Hollywood. And so it goes. My general take on this is that of course, this all gets filtered at the electoral level through a wide variety of differences. Many of them have to do with regional economies. This country is large enough to have, in the past, to have a central empire and a whole string of colonies within its own borders. And one of the
for example, what are you talking about?
Well, the South, once upon a time, was a colony of the Northeast, so was the far Midwest and the mountain states. North Dakota is in fee simple to owned by Pillsbury and Company in Minneapolis, that sort of thing. And so, it's not surprising when you take a look at the demographic and other changes over time that you found a flip-flop in recent years. It has a lot to do with regional political economy. It also has a lot to do with major differences in regional political cultures. And at the present time, as I cast lots looking forward to the November election, What you've got is a pattern which is fairly straightforward. You've got the East Coast, you've got the Upper Midwest, and you've got the Pacific Coast, which, except for Alaska, which is really a mountain state, which you can say are pretty safely Democratic. You've got on the other side what has sometimes been called a big L. The Republicans are talking about this a lot in the 80s, and they claim they had a lock on the Electoral College. That is to say, most of the South, plus the far plain states, plus the mountain states, the L lies on its side. It runs from, say, Norfolk, Virginia, or perhaps I should add Virginia Beach, which is where Pat Robertson comes from, out to Phoenix, Arizona. And then the short part of the L goes from Arizona up to the Montana-Canada line. And so what you've got is a kind of two Americas, geographically speaking, and also in many important respects, I would argue, basically different on a variety of issues. So, for example, nobody really expects Bush to carry Minnesota, for instance. Certainly nobody expects Gore to carry Texas. And the big states that seem to have shifted over the last 10 years or so more heavily Democratic than before include, of course, vote-rich California as well as much but not all of the Northeast. Now, in addition to that, of course, you have a wide divergence across a variety of other lines. Women, for example, are notably more Democratic than men are. This has been true for some time. It's true now. Particularly you subdivide the women among groups. If you talk about professional single women, young, professional, well-educated single women, they are particularly strongly Democratic. And of course, males, particularly those 30 to 45, tend to be exceptionally Republican, and so it goes. So the net result of this is you're going to have a close election this time. Surprise, surprise. Now, some of my friends who do what I sometimes call recreational political science, that is to say the folks who do economics and politics models predicting presidential elections, you've probably seen this. It was reported as a byproduct of the convention of political scientists last week, have predicted an easy Gore win ranging from 54% to 60% or more. Nobody sees this in the polls yet. We may find that we will at the end of the day.
Well, where do they pick it up? The easy Gore win. What's it based on? Is this an electoral college?
Yeah, no, that's not electoral college so much. If a candidate wins by 54% of the national vote, he doesn't have to worry about the electoral college. He'll get enough votes in enough states to win in the electoral college. If it gets real close, it gets interesting. What I'm suggesting is the election at the moment certainly looks a lot closer than these guys are projecting, and it's not out of the ballpark to imagine that Bush could win it, obviously. Although I think at the moment, curiously enough, the electoral college break in my own calculations based on recent performances would suggest that Gore has a slight lead in the electoral college on an equal percentage Democrat-Republican national basis, which is kind of interesting. You don't hear about it. These guys are campaigning, obviously, in the states that are going to be swing, and they include particularly Ohio and Pennsylvania. And I've often said in recent weeks that, the election may be decided somewhere around the state line between the two countries, between the two states.
That's a slip. You said countries.
Well,
we're talking about
almost.
the sort of permanent interests and investment strategies in this presidential campaign 2000 with the political scientist Walter Dean Burnham at the University of Texas in Austin and Tom Ferguson, who teaches political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is a fascinating picture, your L-shaped Republican lock on the plain states, the mountain states, and the South coming east to Florida. And then this sort of...
Well, Florida is at the moment problematic.
Okay, but north to Virginia, and then the sort of solid, more Democratic than ever kind of northeast quadrant. Mm-hmm. Add California to that, and you've got...
And the upper Midwest.
Yes, Minnesota,
Illinois.
Wisconsin, okay.
And including Illinois, which has a very substantial number of electoral votes.
I just want to go back to sort of investment strategies and money, Dean Burnham. I mean, your friend and mine, Kevin Phillips, who's not easily shocked, was really stunned that George Bush of Texas, oil, air, and all that, would pick as his running mate another oil Republican out of his daddy's cabinet.
I guess it's something you feel comfortable with, you know. But, I mean, it is, it seems to me, an extremely narrow base. And Cheney has not exactly been a ball of fire as a campaigner either.
Chris, what's the Chris?
Is it the first all oil ticket in American history or not?
Well, I think Tom probably gives that you know, some context, but I think it's the most explicitly all oil ticket we've ever seen by a country mile. Even if you know, there were oil, major oil interests on both sides in '48 or some other time.
Well, what do you see as the sort of leaps right out as the countervailing interest in the Democratic ticket? Who owns Al Gore, in short?
Well, labor, the teachers' unions, I would assume, the trial lawyers, Hollywood, and a range of quite possibly high-tech types of firms in California and elsewhere who happen to favor Democrats for a variety of reasons that relate to their position in the political economy. I would say those to a large degree.
I'd ask you both. This campaign is generally seen as sort of son of President Bush faces a political son of Bill Clinton. Does the money trail bear that out? Are these simple repetitions of?
I don't think that's strict. I'd want to defer to Tom. He does the analysis of the you know, FEC stuff, Federal Election Commission data, and other things of the sort. He could answer your question. I would doubt that it's exactly a replication. You never step in exactly the same river twice. But there is a certain recent certainly continuity in general.
Tom Ferguson?
Yeah, basically, yes, with, you know, minor qualifications. You don't want to hear about utilities in the Clinton campaign in 92. That's a small, relatively small potatoes. Yeah, basically, it's not a huge change in the lineup. Just a couple of comments, though. Still at the heart of the Gore story is Wall Street, a good solid chunk of it. Those are the folks who have, not only do they make more money than anybody else in the United States, they've got the huge global set of interests that brings you basically, you know, in effect, if you put globalization together with a corrupt campaign finance system, what it means is you can sell everything, literally everything in the world.
What did you have in mind?
You could sell your China policy. You can sell your policy toward Europe. You can sell your policy toward Latin America. There's somebody there who wants something to happen. That's incredibly useful. And if those somebodies happen to have somebody with a lot of money, which is the Wall Street story, there's enough money on Wall Street, it's true for both parties. But the Democrats still get a huge chunk of their money from Wall Street.
That's correct.
And that's really
crucial. Robert Rubin, who was Mr. Yes. Wall Street in the 80s, has been Mr. Washington in the 90s.
And Summers will soon repair there, win or lose. That is to say, you can be sure where he's going.
I want to introduce Larry Makinson, who runs the Center for Responsive Politics and keeps tabs on every one of these campaign contribution reports. Larry, what's the big picture that leaps out in the contest of money, of these interests that you've compiled by sector?
Well, one of the things that does come up, and just to slightly correct Tom on one issue, the Wall Street is really been hedging its bets on both sides here and giving roughly equal amounts, really more so than the other industries, which clearly have preferred the Republicans and the Democrats. I mean, I think Dean Burnham mentioned the ones, and they're basically right, that the trial lawyers, Hollywood, certainly the unions, have been strong supporters of the Democrats for years, which is one reason they can be reliably attacked by the Republicans. They'll talk about labor bosses, greedy trial lawyers, and so on. And then on the Republican side, you've got big tobacco, big oil, and really a variety of other interests. One of the very interesting things that we see, and I might mention that on our website, which is opensecrets.org, which has really portraits of every congressional race, portraits of the presidential candidates, and where the money's coming from.
A very useful page, if I may say, Larry. Go ahead.
Thank you. One of the things that we just actually put on our website starting today was digging into our database and putting 10-year profiles of virtually every industry in the country. So you can actually look and see how the patterns have shifted over the years. And one of the most striking differences that you'll see in virtually every single industry that you look at is how the money shifted after the 1994 election, beginning in 96, when the Republicans took over control of Congress. A lot of the money that goes into American politics isn't really aimed at the presidential level, it's aimed at the congressional level. And in those areas, the name of the game is giving to the people who are in power. One of the strongest patterns you'll ever see in tracking money in politics is that money follows power. And as power shifts in Washington, so does the money. It's very dramatic. So that what happened was that aside from those stalwart industries that I just mentioned that support one party or the other, most other American industries, and this also, by the way, includes the computer industry, which is one of the fastest rising sources of money, really have given, the computer industry has given almost 50-50 to the two parties. But most of the other groups give now about maybe 2-to-1 Republican. And that could shift if the Republicans lose control of Congress. So they tend to really be investors who are very cagey. I think one of the phenomena we've seen in presidential contests for years and years is that there's this rush to the middle, rush to those suburban housewives or whoever the undecideds may be. There's a similar rush to the middle in terms of attracting investors in your campaign.
In a close election, people are going to hedge their bets. But frankly, Larry, I'm much more interested in noticing how unmiddled this thing is. I mean, Chris, the trade unions are in one place, and Hollywood is, and big oil, and as you say, big tobacco, in a very, very different place. Could I just ask you to comment on one particular thing, and that is China policy. How would you track through the money how George Bush's instincts and prospects about China are different from Al Gore's?
I think that's something where you have to rely on the reading between the lines sort of stuff that that Tom Ferguson does.
Let's ask him to read it.
Well, let's get clear here. We don't read between the lines. I mean, I do something slightly different than what the center does. I very much like their work, and Larry knows that. I think it's been incredibly valuable, and in the past, we've worked together on stuff. But I would not work on the way they do, where they do only the donors they can identify. I'd rather work with a systematic sample that I have identified of the large firms. I think I've got a superior method there. Beside that, in interpreting this stuff, and when Larry states, Wall Street, let's stipulate, which I think is not quite true, that they're 50-50 in this election, and most people are 2-to-1. That is evidence for my point, precisely,
right,
that they are overinvested.
Right.
Larry and I don't disagree on the empirical.
But how do you track, for example, China policy intention?
Here's what. Let me tell you what I do. I take the large firms that are out there. That have some policy statements or either up in public or that you know privately, and then look and see if you can find a pattern in them. In effect, what you do is you separate them from the rest of the pack and then see if you can find a statistically detectable difference. That's the method I use. That's the method nobody else in political science, for one curious reason or another, can't bring themselves to do.
What does it tell you about China?
In this case, I haven't pulled it on this data because the data is still coming in. In the past, what it tells me is that the one among the many reasons oil companies like Republicans is China policy, and there is a marked difference noticed by everybody in the two platforms as well as in the attitude toward China. And you just can't get much blunter than Condoleezza Rice on this point. And my memory is she is an advisor to one of the large firms, maybe the BP, though I may be mistaken on that particular point, but she certainly has a long career.
How would you track, for example, interest in free trade, in which Bill Clinton has become a sort of a George Bush Republican himself?
In truth, Chris, on that one, you'll now have a hard time, and this is one reason why both parties are essentially unrestrained global capitalist globalization parties, is there's virtually no large firm in the United States that wants tariffs. I mean, they're just all, everybody is, not quite everybody, but most large firms are now heavily invested abroad. A lot of people do production abroad. If they don't do their own production abroad, they import massively. And the result is that, in effect, both parties, I mean, it's, Buchanan on this single point has it right in the sense that these are clearly economic interests that dominate both major parties there. I mean, one point that's maybe worth making about Gore, you can't read this anywhere in the English language press. You can read it in, say, Handelsblatt, the German press, where it's put out just straightforwardly like I'm talking now. You may remember at the time of 1997-98, when the whole East Asia crisis hit, there was a lot of brave talk, first from Tony Blair and then from Bill Clinton and other leaders, but the Americans, too, were saying, well, we'll get a new global financial architecture that'll prevent this kind of speculative disaster where we have to lay out literally zillions in tax dollars, directly or indirectly. Now, you may notice that nothing has happened on that, just nothing, except, you know, one trash by some Republicans on the World Bank and the IMF. Now, the German press is actually running stories about how Gore and Clinton, and they make the link just straightforwardly as I'm saying it, to cash contributions to the Democratic Party, gutted those plans for reform. Now, since I know a lot of these folks, I can tell you that, yeah, there's a huge block of people in New York that were perfectly blunt in saying there wasn't going to be any new economic order of world money, and they got what they wanted. Well, Gore did it.
Part of the question in this whole discussion in my mind is, why are we Americans and American journalists in general so squeamish about talking about economic interest? We're very heavy on the personality profile and, you know, yeah, where George Bush, his date for the junior prom in high school or something, but not about who's going to write
his policy.
I accept
the challenge. There's really two problems. Why don't they talk about it? And then why do they pick the stupid stuff to talk about that they do, right?
There's a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, the cost of these things in general, very little about who's buying what.
That's right. It's typically, it's an awful lot of money. That's what they call campaign finance analysis. Look at Niagara Falls. See the water go over the cliff. Look, there's basically, I think you got to understand,
We'll start there when we come back from the break. We're talking about campaign investments in the year 2000 between Al Gore and George Bush. With Tom Ferguson in Boston, Walter Dean Burnham at the University of Texas in Austin. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the Gore-Bush Campaign 2000 as an investment opportunity. Connection listeners, is it too cynical, or is it basically common sense to say that this campaign is not about tweaking the HMOs or improving the performance in public schools so much as a question of who owns Al Gore, who owns George Bush, and what do those investors want when and if their guy wins? The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Professor Tom Ferguson from the University of Massachusetts in Boston is our guest in the studio. Professor Walter Dean Burnham, who was his teacher, joins us from the University of Texas in Austin.
Yeah, wait a minute here. Listen
senior
to what
colleague.
Dean's saying. I never had the benefit of Dean as a teacher.
Junior colleague. I'm not his teacher.
Yeah. Well, you're my teacher.
I would have been better off if I were a student.
Is it too cynical, Tom, to call it a contest of buying this election?
No. What's the matter with the simple, straightforward investment approach, which says, you know, you get what you pay for? Now, given that you got a big show out there with a lot of heterogeneous interests, at least not when we're talking about labor policy or maybe tax policy, though this year we got a gap on tax policy, not all these differences, in fact, most of them don't translate into much for the ordinary person. I mean, both parties are going to push this drug war in Colombia, you know, with the U.S. troops on the ground there, regardless. So, you know, whoever wins. But, you know, this is a year. It is kind of interesting by past standards. If you just sit down and listen to Gore's acceptance speech, which I did, and then I got the thing and counted up. He actually, quite unusually for folks accepting presidential nominations from major parties, actually lists half a dozen industries that he wants to hit, regulate, or otherwise constrain. And then you start asking yourself, what chunk of the U.S. economy are those industries? And the answer, it's a big part of it. Now, this has actually been a very striking feature all through the Clinton era, and I've actually written this up before, that Clinton, when you look at, say, the top 500 firms in the United States and just the people he had trouble with, and this is the most pro-business Democratic administration since Grover Cleveland.
Absolutely.
He is nevertheless at war with something like 60% of the large-scale businesses in the U.S. on things like the environment.
Well, you know, the question is, Larry Makin's not in Washington, the question is, how much really is he at war with those groups? How much was that playing to the crowd in the convention hall in Los Angeles? And how much do the people who are investing in this election really understand that there are certain things that a politician has to say, but that when it comes down to what policy is enacted, there's going to be a middle ground, which is, I think, the middle ground that Bill Clinton exploited brilliantly. He was never the first choice of Republicans, but he was an acceptable second choice. And I think that's the same ground that Al Gore is going for.
Could I just observe... Well, actually, no, not quite. I mean, in fact, if you look particularly, say, in the first 2 years of Clinton's term, where he got attacked unrelentingly for stuff that we would indeed, I think, regard as relatively small differences, you know, fights over Western lands. The health care thing was not a small difference. That was a biggie. That was maybe right. One of the all-time great political...
The 93 budget wasn't a small difference.
That's right.
Take a look at the roll call.
That's right. It's not correct to say that they all occupied a middle ground. And this is a point, again, where I would differ with Larry's stuff, but they haven't. And it's just because the center, I think, has not carried out its analysis within. You can see that money shifting early in the 94 campaign. I've written this up. It's real obvious when you look at, say, the soft money. In this sense, I would not accept that money follows power. There's clearly a sense, and 94 was very clearly a case where money led power. That was really a wall of money that Clinton sent in operation. Essentially, he had all these folks walking around the Republican side saying, this is class war. Now, of course, you'd say class war is what the Republicans are doing. They just don't want anybody to talk about it.
That's
well,
right.
And... But it is clear that I would not underplay the differences within the business community. And the reason this is so hard to understand is you'd say, geez, all the parties are moving to the right. How come they all can't disagree more? The short, blunt answer is that the pressures of globalization to sort of get rid of the welfare state and most of what you'd regard as, say, New Deal-type reforms in the United States are overwhelming. And in truth, the whole center of gravity in the business community has moved way to the right, far more than, you know, the population. I mean, there is just this persisting gap between public opinion on, say, Social Security and all the sort of funny little proposals people keep coming out to get rid of it, whittle it away or cut it down.
Dean Burnham, do you agree?
Basically, I would agree almost 100% with that analysis.
Just let me ask you, Dean Burnham, why is it that we find it so hard to report this kind of thing and talk about politics this way? I mean, in the Clinton years, we've learned...
I'll give you two reasons that occur to me. One is what you might call absorption in the general political culture, of the general culture of what Antonio Gramsci would call hegemony, by the reporters and by the press in general. They buy into unexamined assumptions on a large scale because that's the way the culture is put together. Secondly, there is, of course, the fact of, the notion that news is a business, and that its product is actually advertising, the byproduct is what the people actually hear, which is a limited, very limited share of what there actually is out there to hear. And if you don't want to bite your advertisers in the rear end, they don't like it, they cease to advertise, you wind up with a bad bottom line.
I think that's one of the things that that publishers certainly think about, and most questionable, most undoubtedly network executives do. I don't think that's a sort of...
I don't get it, though. I don't get it. Why couldn't you sell papers by talking about oil interests confronting Hollywood interests? I mean,
once upon a time, you used to do that back in the progressive era. You had muckraking journalism and all the rest of this stuff, but that was a
ton of years ago.
Chris, if I may just support Dean here, it is perfectly clear that the bulk of revenue for most media come from advertising. They don't come from reader sales. I mean,
obviously not.
And that's decisive.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the bottom line. The bottom line is the bottom line, to which we could add something else, which is just put yourself now in the position of an American politician that has to give the speeches. You can't get up and say, vote for me, I'm bought, and I'm planning to take money out of your pocket. You got to talk about something. What you therefore get is this funny Aesopian rhetoric about family values and all this crap. It's basically you're filling the time. Now, the reporters have essentially two choices. They can essentially strike out on their own with zero support from their editor and their publisher, and listen while the politicians and everybody else trashes them for being weird, or they can just sit down, shut up, and write what they hear. They do that. I well remember going
to a... That's common sense, Tom.
Yeah, I understand, but we both know just what in short supply that is in certain fields and, for that matter, more generally in the culture. It's a nice case of this...
Maybe it's Adam Clymer's turn now to be some...
Hey, now, Adam Clymer reviewed my first book in the New York Times, and it was obvious that he simply could not abide thoughts of campaign finance actually having a serious impact. I mean, when I read George Bush's comment yesterday, I confess... Gee, I thought maybe I have some common ground here after all. But this is exactly what's wrong with American journalism. Bush doesn't like it, but
well,
you
Ben,
still...
Ben Bagdikian wrote a book some years ago called The Media Monopoly, which goes a long way toward blocking this out. I'd also refer to Pat Sparrow's recent book, Uncertain Guardians, which is a fine study of the media as a business and why business imperatives get in the way of certain other stated objectives of the enterprise.
Well, we can talk about anything we want here on The Connection, and we're going to do it. And we're going to talk more about the money interests in this campaign. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Joe is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Joe.
Hi. Yeah. Question about Hollywood. The screenwriter Joe Esterhaus recently took out an ad in the magazine Variety, and he was urging all his colleagues in Hollywood not to give money to the Democratic Party until Joe Lieberman started explaining his views on government regulation of Hollywood. And I wonder what your guests think about that.
Tom Ferguson.
All right. The short, blunt answer is this is a very interesting case because the Lieberman nomination combined with the what I would call almost classically American liberal speech that Gore gave is a really interesting and provocative thing. I mean, my reaction, I confess, when I heard the Gore speech was, gee, great speech. I wonder if he means any of it. The real choice Gore made at the convention was to put in Lieberman as his vice president. And Lieberman on medical care, on insurance, is very conservative. And it's true. He has not in the past defended views that Hollywood's likely to find very convenient. Now, you know, in politics, I think, you know, it may be the newspapers may wish you to sort of listen to what they say. You should listen instead to what, you remember, John Mitchell of Happy Memory used to watch what we do, not what we say. I think the case for Gore in general is you don't have to believe all his rhetoric. The question is, what does Hollywood think about Lieberman? I suspect that that's a minor problem for them, not a major one. That Lieberman will, in fact, he's had a career of following the money with almost slavish devotion since he got into Congress. I doubt he will change now that he's on a national stage. I think you can see, watch what happens. There'll be, if they win, there'll be a couple of highlighted dinners at which, you know, 50 starlets and stars turn out with Lieberman, and then there'll be all this endless talk about Lieberman is learning about Hollywood. Hollywood is learning about Lieberman, and everybody agrees we've got to do something to protect America's youth from Hollywood, and then nothing will happen except the Democrats will stay very rich. That's what I think is going to happen.
Joe, does that answer your question?
That makes sense. That works out.
That works out. Yeah, I agree.
As long as Tipper goes along with it, too.
I pass.
1-800-423-8255. Brian is on the line.
Hi, a rather cynical hour, but a good one.
I don't know. Why? You know, that always bugs me when people say reporters are cynical.
Well,
the politicians are the cynics, Brian.
Absolutely. But I just wanted to ask, and I'll take my comments off air, to what extent do your panel feel that the politicians stay bought once they've received these political contributions? And I would remind them of the late Representative Jesse Unruh's motto that if you can't take their money, drink their booze, and use their women, and then vote against them, then you don't belong in this business. And I'll listen off air. Thank you.
That sounds like a good point. There, Theodore Roosevelt was attacked by one of his givers with the phrase, we bought the SOB, and he didn't stay bought.
That's right. It was just
they used to say, you can't buy so-and-so, but you can rent him.
Yeah, partly. You put it this way. You get favorable consideration, but politicians who are worth their salt understand it's a highly complex world, and they have many constituents to pacify in order to get what they want and also to stay on top of the slippery pole. And so they are perfectly prepared, given the right circumstances, to do things that their givers wouldn't like very much. But typically what tends to happen, given the polarization that really does exist in the society, in this rather narrow range of alternatives, is that the other guys really usually don't have any place to go. I'll bet you at the end of the day, Joe Esterhaz votes for Gore, even if he doesn't give quite as much as he used to.
Probably so, and if I could add here from
D.C.,
I think there's a real disconnect, or a huge disconnect that I think has been sort of touched on here between public politics and insider politics.
Sure.
And I think politicians will keep delivering for the people who supply their campaigns with money because they do buy long-term relationships.
That's correct.
That issue stays inside, as long as it doesn't blow up into headlines that begin to embarrass
them. If it does, you fundamentally change the rules.
Right.
That's exactly right. That's what we in the trade call a Schaff-Snyder mobilization. And when that sort of stuff happens, and it does from time to time, all bets tend to be off for the time being.
It's one of the things that makes your disclosures interesting, Larry, is that you do sort of lifetime investments in these candidates and their whole careers, and they do add up. It's fascinating, especially in the case of George Bush, George W. Bush in this case. He's got 25 sort of permanent investors, each one of them bigger than any of the permanent investors in Al Gore, but they say something, and I presume they come back for a reason.
They do. I think also you might be confusing the Center for Responsive Politics with the Center for Public Integrity.
Maybe I am. I'm sorry.
Which does do career patrons and did a book called The Buying of The Buying of the President, and has done it twice now. But it's absolutely correct. In fact, one of the things we found when we did this 10-year survey of basically all industries and what their giving was, if you look at the section of who got the most money from most of these groups over that 10-year period, George W. Bush actually leads, even though he's only been a candidate since 1999. He's collected more money than virtually any other politician in America from most industries, simply from the time he's dipped his toe into national politics.
Tom Ferguson, I'd like you to go back and sort of walk us through some of the differences you highlighted. I mean, on a lot of important points, drug war in Colombia.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff
casino capitals they agree on. But the differences do show up, by your analysis, in military spending,
yeah,
in the size of tax cuts.
That's right.
And in Medicare
care
reform.
And to some extent, education policy.
Yeah.
There. Now, on the education policy, I feel obliged to observe. Hey, I'm here in my private capacity, not somebody from UMass. But I will have to say that I think it's a mistake to treat Gore as a pawn of unions. In a sense, it's clear within that campaign there is enormous stress. It's also clear to me that the Gore people have walked a long way from the sort of preferred teacher union positions, for instance, on their now
sure.
studies on standards and stuff like that. And you'll probably see a good deal more of that in the future. The teachers essentially don't have enough cash, so they got a lot, and they got a lot of bodies. I mean, they're something like the sort of shock troops of the Democratic Party for the ground, sort of the infantry, if you like, around election time. But all right, now the big story, it seems to me, is on Social Security, medical stuff, and education. Let's just talk through some of this stuff. First, on Social Security, it's very clear that the Bush people, I know this sounds crazy, and you're going to want to get out your butterfly net, but in fact, Bush sort of ran out of money at the end of the campaign, at the end of the primary. He basically blew through something like $75 million to beat McCain. It was a really amazing, I mean, you typically do what I call the Russian Army style of campaign in the Republican Party. You just, essentially, it's the way Dole blew away everybody. You just outspend everybody, usually by 3, 4, 5, in this case, what was it, about five times? I forget. Anyway, And the guy actually ran short of dough, in the sense he's not taking matching money, so he can't just go to the public trough. He's got to go to the private trough, you know, this home of free enterprise that is somehow better. Well, anyway, so to the private trough he went. And what he did was pretty interesting. He came out with this privatization plan for Social Security. Now, that is aimed at a Democratic base at Wall Street. It's a cornucopia for these folks, because if they get the plan they really want, it's they can charge us all fees for each individual account.
Yes.
And it's simply an outrage. Okay, there's just nothing in it, and it will destroy the existing public Social Security system, because they can't finance the transition costs in it. That has, you know, there's an inflow of cash into the Bush campaign. That's a nice case where Social Security, he clearly went for full-throated privatization after thinking a long time about it, and I think being a little scared of it, because he wanted the cash. Now, the Gore business is a little, in the campaign, it's a little more highly contrasted than it really is. He says, I want to preserve the existing system. He does. He also wants to add, at least in the past, private accounts as a sort of supplement, but that's a big difference. I mean, they really will. If the Bush people enact privatization, the average American voter is going to see a lot less in their Social Security checks.
Sketch the difference on medical care.
Okay, on
Medicaid, Medicare,
okay, yeah.
Patients' Bill of Rights.
All right, this is endlessly complicated. The bottom line lineup is this: most of the private sector loves private sector medicine. What a surprise! On the other hand, you got a big chunk, some HMOs, a big chunk of the nonprofit sector, especially the research hospitals, and a good chunk of the medical profession that don't like becoming, in effect, factory workers, are all opposed. The result is there is a very affluent constituency, and we start right here in New England, you know, where the New England Journal of Medicine
right.
is virtually their vehicle.
The doc.
Here. Yeah, where they don't like, if you like, what we may call industrial medicine, or if you like, just pure free market medicine. Beyond that, you've got the patients, right? And the patients don't like it either, because you get these loons coming in insurance companies who won't let you do operations you obviously need, and who want to second-guess doctors with a bunch of people either using computers or clerks or who know nothing about health. The result is you got big issue differences there among constituencies, and it's very clear, despite the pharmaceutical plan that Bush put forth this morning, which, if you look at it, it's a joke. I mean, it'll cover people essentially up to about 14 grand, and after that, they're offering to subsidize a tiny bit of your medical premiums. Well, just subsidizing medical premiums won't contain medical costs. I mean, in any other context, the Republicans would call it throwing money at problems, and they'd say this is a typical Democratic idea. But they got to do something.
Well, there's an auction going on, Tom.
So where we're at here is essentially, if you get Gore, you probably will get, one, a patient's bill of rights; two, you probably will get a better pharmaceutical program for payment of drugs. That's a huge difference.
It's straightforward self-interest for a lot of people.
We're all getting old, I regret to say. I mean,
Dean Burnham, explain your auction.
Yeah, I'm a drugstore at this point myself.
What do you mean about the auction?
I mean just that. I mean, what you're listening to from Bush is, and in a sense from Gore, too, is, of course, on the Democratic side you're more used to, the Republican side a little less. I mean, basically, he's promising almost the moon from a Tom DeLay point of view in order to get elected. He's raising the stakes. You know, I expect him to come out for full prescription drug coverage before the end of the campaign if the race is going, although probably not, actually.
But no, is this driven by voters and public opinion, or is it driven by money?
The whole thing. We think we can make an offer to folks that they can't refuse.
Look, the Bush people have learned the art of selling more than 100% of the budget.
Of course they have. There's no time like a surplus time in order to do that. So the whole story has entirely changed from what it was 10 years ago.
Well, yeah, with one comment I would add to that, though, which is when you look at these surpluses and the economic projections they're based on,
mm-hmm.
they're clearly not going to materialize to the extent that both campaigns, neither Gore nor Bush.
Obviously, but that's part of the auction.
That's just all there is to it. They're assuming that's part of the auction.
I mean, we're hypothecating not only the future, but the hereafter.
I want to ask you, and maybe this is for you, Tom Ferguson, what is yet to learn about these candidates from the money trail between now and November? What should we be watching?
Well, for somebody like me, I'd like to sort of take them apart in more fine-grained detail, and for that, you just need time to go through the data. Myself, I think everybody knows enough right now that you can sort of state, and I think we pretty well have covered a lot of it. The geography is pretty well covered here right now. You're not going to suddenly discover that George Bush is going to, like, regulate pharmaceuticals or something.
Yeah.
This is just not going to happen. You're not going to discover that, you know, Al Gore is going to suddenly favor a full oil policy.
Or tort reform.
Or tort reform. Yes, exactly. Indeed, you know, you can be absolutely sure that whatever reforms the Democrats are doing, they'll take this peculiar legal form where they invite you to sue to maintain your rights instead of having the government do it.
This has been fun and useful, I think. Tom Ferguson, thank you. Walter Dean Burnham in Texas and Larry Makinson at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, thank you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation about the money trail on our website at theconnection1word.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, providing banking and investment services to successful people, their families, and their businesses. By humorist Jimmy Tingle and his new one-man show, Jimmy Tingle for President, running at the Comedy Connection Faneuil Hall.